Okay, well, you're entitled to know my motives in discussing this subject. As many of you know, I've been bitten by the internal inflation bug. So why am I talking about this reasonably technical, straightforward, well-defined subject? Okay. The reason is the very interesting proposal of Dio and Ninos, Tom Hartman and Andy Strominger, for a sharp version of DSCFD holography, connecting the cilia of gravity to a vector-like theory of future consider infinity. We're going to hear more about that tomorrow, I think both morning and afternoon, so I'm not going to say anything about that. But you're entitled to know what's in the back of my mind when I'm talking about this. And the stuff I'm going to talk about really started as a practice problem for me to try to learn the machinery so I would understand that proposal. All right. So just to set the stage, let me give a lightning review of the kind of vector-like holography that I'm going to discuss. So the boundary, this is an ADS-CFD duality. The boundary is 2 plus 1 dimensional. I'll explain why in a minute. We have n free scalars, phi sub I. They're in vector, and vector-like holography. They're not matrices. And in the ON singlet sector, you could have complex scalars in the SUN singlet, or UN singlet. And we'll actually talk about that because it's easier for me to think about SUN than ON. And the fields you talk about, the singlet bilinear, or a whole slew of conserved currents with higher and higher spins. I is summed over, you have derivatives up to S, making spin S conserved currents. And these things on the bulk, which is 3 plus 1 anti de Sitter, it describes a bulk theory not of ordinary gravity, but of this very intricate structure of the cilia of gravity that has a bulk scalar and higher spin fields. Of all spin, technically in the ON theory, they're all even spin. And in the SUN theory, they're all and Vasilyev wrote down a nonlinear field equation coupling all these higher spin fields and scalar together. That was consistent. I understand nothing about it, so I will not entertain questions about it. Okay. Some people in this room might know more than me.
Steve?
Yeah.
Just a simple question. So,
I issued by alternative, but go ahead and ask.
In the cases I understand, the scalars in the bulk are dual to symmetric traceless products of scalars on the boundary.
Right.
So when you write phi I in your boundary theory, is that literally phi I?
It's some on I.
It's some on I, yeah, but that's the sort of thing which is not protected in the usual theory, right? That's
it's protected.
It has some high anomalous
free
symmetry.
Because it's free.
Oh.
It's the best kind of protection. No supersymmetry anywhere. G. Newton, the thing that tells you that these objects are weakly coupled, is 1 over n, not 1 over n squared. Because these things are vectors. And if you do the diagram chasing, you get one over n's in the, or n's in the loops, not in the square. Okay. There is also a variant of this where you don't have a free theory, you have an interacting vector-like theory. This is a famous system, the Wilson-Fisher fix point in three dimensions at large M. This is sometimes referred to as a critical OM model. And it has a 1 over M expansion. So this model is not free, but it's controllable. The main thing that happens in the free theory, this has conformal weight 1 because it has two weight a half scalar fields. They're free. Here, the bilinear has delta equals 2. This corresponds to a scalar. This corresponds to a scalar with the alternate boundary conditions. So both of these correspond to the same bulk theory, where you change the boundary conditions. Again, 1 and 2 are d and d minus delta. They're one of these standard pairing situations. What I'm not going to talk about is a very interesting variant of higher spin gravity, where the bulk, the
boundary. Is that what you're going to say about this duality?
Well, I'm going to do some tests and stuff on it. But
this is a conjecture.
Yeah, I'll talk just a bit about the evidence that exists.
And the other question is, the right half, the bulk side has two parameters, right?
Well,
as a radius.
Well, it's really just got one. It's got the ratio of M Planck to
what is the coefficient?
One over M. That's the only parameter is M.
Yeah, so that's always confused me. And when Michael was here, Mike Dennis was here, couldn't answer exactly.
I couldn't answer.
On the right hand side, you got two parameters.
What are the two parameters?
The radius of radius.
Yes.
And the constant.
But there's only the dimensionless ratio is the ratio.
Only one dimensionless ratio.
Yeah, that's what matters is the dimensionless numbers. 1 over G Newton measured it. This is measured in ADS units. That's the only dimensionless ratio. There's not an analog of the Tuff coupling. There's not a separate string scale and Planck scale, as you might have in supergetting mills. That's not there. It really is there, but I haven't told you what it is yet.
Is the string coupling essentially 1 or something?
0.
It is the string scale, and there aren't strings, first of all. And it's like lambda equals, I won't say that, but there's no separate coupling. There is secretly going to be a separate coupling, so I don't want to belabor that.
So. L string is secretly 0.
Well, there aren't strings, really.
Whatever.
Yeah, but there's no extra parameter like M string over M Planck that you can dial smoothly.
So what's the answer to Gary's question for the second model? Why?
This theory at large N, this theory is a controllable conformal field theory that has a 1 over N expansion. So it's almost, it free isn't the right word, but it's got a reference fixed point with controllable 1 over N corrections to the
control. But it's an isolated fixed point.
It's an isolated fixed point, yeah. That's controllable. And this is the main difference. It continues to have these conserved currents at large N. The only difference is this. I'm not going to talk about, Tom Hartman will talk a great deal about, but I'll just mention the boundary theory that's 1 plus 1 dimensional, that's a WM CFT. And the bulk is 2 plus 1, and there's a higher spin gravity that's described by an SLNR Chern-Simons gauge theory in the bulk, plus some other stuff, a couple of scalars, maybe some other stuff, okay. So I'm going to leave this to Tom Hartman. In many ways, this theory you can do more with, but I'm not going to talk about it because I'm interested in the sitter space. That's my reason. Also, this is harder than free field theory. Although that I'm going, part of my talk is to argue that's not completely the case. Okay. So this is. All right, well, what's the evidence that this works? And it's true. I mean, it's beyond a reasonable doubt. The evidence, the first evidence, this conjecture was due to Klebanov and Vinokourov. They counted states on both sides and showed that they were the same. And I think in many ways the The heroes of this story are Simone Giambi and Shi Yin, who in a real tour de force dug into this nonlinear field equation, understood it sufficiently well to be able to compute three-point functions and show that they were the same as both the free theory and the critical theory. And after that, the game was up. Since then, Maltesena and Zhibonev showed that if you have a theory with exactly conserved higher spin currents, the only possible correlations on the boundary are those of a free field. Okay, that does not address the critical theory, but in the free theory, that's the end. Okay. So if you, the end, this is true, and I'm not going to entertain any more questions about whether it's not true. There's one last important piece of the story that's going to come back over and over again in my talk, which is we talk about being in the singlet sector, okay? There's no corresponding things here corresponding to phi sub I, okay? Now, we're very familiar with this from the standard dualities. And the way that you enforce singlet constraints is you have a gauge invariance. This is crucial because you don't want to just arbitrarily enforce singlet conditions. You want your boundary theory to be a local quantum field theory. So it has a local stress tensor, so it can correspond to bulk gravity. So we need some local Lagrangian that only produces singlets. Okay, so we need some kind of gauge theory. But as soon as you start putting conventional Yang-Mills gauge theories, you all of a sudden have gluons. And they're n squared gluons compared to this measly n scalar field. So they just wash out the scalar field. So you need a kind of gauge principle that doesn't have gluons. Okay, so the proposal, I think, of Giambi and Yin was to use the only kind of gauge theory we know that doesn't have gluons, which is a Chern-Simons gauge theory.
G goes
to zero limit. That still has gluons. It has free gluons. And in statistics, in the thermal partition function, it would have decoupled abelian gluons. So it has those states. They don't couple, but they're there. Okay. The only theory that doesn't have anything like that is Chern-Simons theory.
So I have the impression that this Vasiliev story is continuing at higher dimensions.
Not this precise story.
Not this precise story.
No, the field equation, sorry, I didn't mean to throw that at you.
There's no conjecture dwelling the vector model in higher dimensions.
I think not. I think not the one that satisfies all these conditions. I think if you impose the singlet constraint, there is a field equation and there's a list like this. But if you want to carefully have something that might make sense non-perturbatively, I don't think you can do it. Well, there isn't a proposal I know about for precisely this reason.
Sorry, it's nice to enforce this by a gauge field.
Yes.
Why is it necessary in terms of just saying that open space and this thing?
Well, I think because you want the theory to have a stress tensor. You want there to be a local Lagrangian on the bulk.
Stress tensor is a singlet.
No, but if you start doing sort of arbitrary things like projections, the theory won't be local. You'll be making non-local constraints on the theory. And so if you break the locality of the boundary theory, you're not guaranteed to have something that the response to a change in the boundary metric will be purely given by a stress tensor. Okay? The locality in the boundary, which will create some weird effects somewhere in the bulk.
How do I break the locality of my projections by considering my projections about this one?
Well, you just arbitrarily have left out, you have to measure something very non-local to decide if it's a singlet or not. Okay, that's a non-local operation on the theory. Well, you have to do a measurement on a whole spatial slice.
Local symmetry is not local. Theory's not local. That's not true.
No, if you do projections on a global symmetry willy-nilly, I mean, it violates clustering and all kinds of things like that. I mean, you don't want to do projections that do things like that. I think it violates clustering, among other things.
The particular problem is the partition function will change if you truncate it to just the singlet sector.
Yeah.
And so therefore, the response to the partition function to a change in metric, the stress tensor in that sense, depends on the answer.
Yeah, the question is, could there be two alternate duals to this theory? They would only differ probably non-perturbatively or something, where you just by hand project.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think you could destroy the Cauchy boundary. You don't, certainly don't destroy a cluster.
You don't, I thought
you act with a singlet on the vacuum. Mm-hmm. You only get singlet states. There's no projection required.
Okay, well, let's return to that, because that's going to be an important point, because this coupling to the Chern-Simons field is going to have dramatic effects.
Yes.
And
you've already stated a total duality, right? And you've never had to invoke something, a dynamical mechanism for imposing the singlet sector.
That's right.
So there is a one-to-one correspondence. Might be interesting, because I gather what you're going to do is now modify with different boundary conditions.
That's right. That's
an interesting extension, but I don't see why it's. Maybe I'm missing something.
I think to be really sure that you've got a dual, I think having a manifestly local theory on the boundary is a. No. I mean a local Lagrangian. I mean projecting by hand on singlets is not a local operation.
Is it possible to make a composite cage? Is it possible to make a composite cage out of the device?
I don't know the answer to that.
I thought people tried that.
Well, sorry, you mean, I think I know what you're talking about.
Logically, you write it down a quartic interaction, which also looks like it's caging. I think there's some composite way to do that. It's
actually, maybe I don't know what you're talking about. I think there's a way. Yeah.
As far as like mu equals 5d mu 5.
Right. But that won't couple to the OM. That's like one of the stringy gauge fields. That won't couple to the OM because the phi d mu phi is a singlet. So to make a gauge field that couples to the OM is a I'm not sure how to do that. All right.
There is a concrete question here, right? I mean, if you tip the bottom where you just truncate the energies, and then you computed the variation vector of the metric, do you get the naive stress tensor or not? That I guess is the question.
Right. Well, for instance, we can turn the question in two dimensions. Okay, where the answer to this is quite clear. Because there you understand something called, and this is something that Tom, you'll probably talk about, but let me, because it's come up. In two dimensions, where you have a circle spaces in S1, you might say you could project on singlet states on the circle, and that would be a consistent conformal field theory. We know we can't, because there you have modular invariance. Okay, so if you
have, in a sense, composite modules, right? This is a free theory.
You can do that, you can do it in 1 plus 1. You could have free bosons in 1 plus 1, or free fermions. And you can say, I want to project on the singlet state. That theory cannot be put on higher genus surfaces, like the thermal torus. Consistent model. No, but that's, we want to study the theory on interesting manifolds, okay? And there, what you have to do is you have to, if you project in on the singlet sector, you also have to study the twisted field, twisting by the thing that implements. So that's the kind of issue that you want to worry about.
Right.
All right, so I want to talk about a couple of things having to do with this duality. Well, the first thing is that Sheehan and I tried to exercise this duality by, in particular, heating it up and looking for black holes. That's one of the most interesting things about the standard ADS-CFT duality. And that was something that actually was done with great success in this 1 plus 1 duality by Per Krause and Perlmutter, his collaborator. So the first thing we want to do is heat this up. Well, this is pretty simple to heat up. It's a free field theory in the singlet sector. The only non-trivial situation is that it is in the singlet sector. Okay. So we have to heat up the free boson state in the singlet sector. The arithmetic is simple. I won't go through the details. It's just like studying a free gauge theory in the cichlid sector, a calculation that was done by Acheroni, Minwala, Van Romsdonk, Marsano. I think I probably missed a name. And the idea is you take space to be an S2, time to be a thermal circle, S1. You put a holonomy, it's really the Chern-Simons holonomy, on the circle, U, in the timeline direction, a unitary matrix, let's say the SUN case. And you integrate over U, so you have an integral du of some weighting factor. The weighting factor is the result of integrating out all this vector-like matter. So E to the S matter. And the integral over the holonomy projects you on the singlet. And then in the gauge theory case, you find that there's a competition here that results in a phase transition. Let me just remind you a bit. If U is, you diagonalize U, call its eigenvalues alpha. The measure for du is d alpha times the van der Waals squared of the alphas. The van der Waals squared, as you all know, has the effect of pushing the eigenvalues apart. It makes them want to spread out on the alpha circle. The matter part wants the eigenvalues to cluster. It doesn't like a non-trivial holonomy. And so there, in the gauge theory part, there's a balance. And at a certain finite temperature, they balance, the eigenvalues clump, this famous Gross-Witten transition. Here, superficially at least, we have trouble. Matter here, it's only in the fundamental. This van der Waal is of order n squared. There's n gluons interacting with n eigenvalues interacting with all the other n gluons. The matter, because it's fundamental, is only a term of strength n. So superficially, they never balance against each other. And so it looks like you never break these singlets apart into their constituents, which is what we would expect at high temperature and would be the hallmark of a deconfined phase with entropy. That would be if we broke the singlets apart and got the analog of deconfined gluons. This isn't quite true, and one of the things we realized is that one way of getting the matter thing to compete is to heat the theory up very hot, so you have so many gluons, scalar quanta, that this effect does become very strong. How many scalar quanta are there? There's T squared scalar quanta, because it's two spatial dimensions. So if you make T squared of order n, then this matter term will actually have an extra factor of n in it that can then compete with the n squared. Okay, so at Tc, that's of order square root of n, so T squared is n. These things do compete, and you go from having uniform eigenvalues to clumped up eigenvalues, again in a standard Gross-Witten phase transition. So at very high temperatures, the theory, in fact, does deconfine into its vector-like constituents. But the theory is very mild. It doesn't undergo the kind of transition at order one that you might expect. And this is because the theory is vector-like. It doesn't have strings. It just has bilinears. And so there's not a kind of Hagedorn transition that drives the theory over the edge. And in fact, the transition is equal, just to show you that we did something, it was square root of 3 over pi. And above Tc is equal to mt squared, but notice t is very large, so it really goes like n squared above Tc, okay? Because you have so many quanta around. And just to say a word about how this transition happens, below Tc, in what you might have called the confined region, this calculation, which you can do easily, shows you the entropy is like T to the fourth. Let me restore dimensions for a minute, times the dimension of the two-dimensional sphere squared. So it has no n in it, but it doesn't look extensive. And the reason is, the natural objects are phi I of x, phi I of y, at separated x and y points. So you have these bilinears where the ends can move anywhere on the sphere, so you get something that goes like a volume squared. That's the natural entropy of these confined objects. They're not like strings. This is the natural analog of strings in this theory, bilinears. I think, Joe, you and Lenny use these as baby versions of precursors. Well, you could have called it something fancy if you wanted to. And so what happens is these bilinears sort of fill up the sphere, and eventually there's so many of them that they get in each other's way, and you don't know which partner you're aligned with, and then the theory falls apart into its constituents. And it falls apart not in a violent first-order transition, but when this is about equal to this. And you can see that's when T is of order square root of M. That's when these entropies are there. It's a second-order transition. The entropies don't jump. And it's this gas of bilinear objects getting in each other's way, finally saying, why do I care who I'm paired with? Let me just float around independently.
Sorry, is that a sharp statement that there's no discontinuity in entropy, or just that it's not going from order to order?
In the calculation, it's a third order gross Witten transition. Okay. So it is not even saying there's no discontinuity.
Can we think of this T to the fourth as really being T squared for each end?
You can very much. It's exactly that. It's exactly that. Sorry, but no N.
No N, right.
Yeah. And so this is, in fact, a number of people, like Anton Javitsky and have gone back, have emphasized that this kind of theory you should rewrite as bilinear objects. Instead of talking about it as a string theory, it's a bilinear theory. That's a characteristic of all these vector-like relatives. And there just aren't enough bilinears to cause a violent Hagedorn transition. So the theory stays mild up to the high temperatures.
Do the baryons in this theory mean anything?
Yes, I'll talk about that in just a minute. Well, what this means is that there is no standard large ADS black hole that dominates the free energy at order one. There's no classical solution to Vasilia, whatever that means. There are classical field equations whose free energy dominates the one of hot thermal space at temperatures of order one. You have to go up to this very high temperature, which is outside the domain of classical physics. I should have said that this means that in this dimension that M Planck over is of order square root of M. So this temperature is of order M Planck. So the classical equations don't know about this scale. The theory has to remember some of its quantum aspects to find this temperature. Worse, there are no effectively black hole solutions to this Vasiliev theory. The only one that's okay. You'll have to ask somebody else. The equations are not easy to.
But the equations contain Einstein's equations.
And everything else.
There's a lot of gauge freedom. So you have a space time which looks like a black hole, you can do gauge transformations and make it not look like a black hole. Because
of
the metric
mechanism of these
higher spins.
It's not consistent to Chernoff
holding
higher spins.
The possibility
is not even a well-defined notion in Vasiliev theory. Because you've enlarged the diffeomorphism group.
Because
you've enlarged the diffeomorphism group. So things like causal structure, Ricci curvature, Ricci scalars, are no longer gauge invariant quantities at all.
Is this related to the fact that there's no large radius limit?
Large radius meaning that all the other modes go off?
Yeah, well, the coupling scale that enters for all the higher
radius. That's right. There certainly is not. All the modes come crashing down in that kind of limit.
But you do not expect this phase to be governed by a classical solution to Vasiliev.
Which one? The high temperature phase? I actually think it should.
Even though the Vasiliev theory.
Very high temperature? Yeah, I think it should. It must correspond to the Poincaré slicing. You know, where the entropy is always mt squared as soon as you're at finite temperature. It's hard for me to imagine there's not some solution that looks like that.
But even though it's a Planck scale, even though you have to have Planck scale curvatures, presumably.
Well, that's an issue, but.
That's what Perrin had to do, probably.
Yes.
I mean, this transition looks moderately similar to the actual Hockey Dot transition in AGS 5 for n equals 4, which is at string scale. The Hocking page is at the temperature of water 1.
Yes.
But there's a Hockey Dot transition in AGS 5, which is at scale set of
preemptive, yes.
But that's not something you would see, hope to see in classical.
That's true.
So likewise, here, why don't we expect to see this in classical?
Well, it's just that we don't see the other one.
I have a question. Yeah. So there's really sort of two possible bulk solutions. It could be either a small black hole with a very small black scale horizon or a large black hole.
Yeah.
Because large black holes have positive specific heat and ABS.
Yes.
So in principle, it could be a huge black hole whose horizon size is much larger than the ABS.
Yeah, that would be right. That would be the naive.
That could be a classical solution.
Right.
That might.
So why isn't that?
Well, somehow the thing that tells you that would be the candidate, but then the question about why it dominates at a temperature that doesn't, where the classical equations wouldn't know about this scale. You know, we have to somehow know about the Planckian corrections to the classical equation.
So what happens if you just take that black hole solution?
Which one? The putative one with large.
It's not a solution.
The higher strength fields are sourced inevitably.
The nonlinear.
There's not some truncation. Let me make a couple of comments and some other kind of clues about what might be going on. You might say, okay, there's never a large black hole that dominates. You might say, all right, is there something subdominant?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, well, we have so much control, at least over the free field, that we can ask that question. We can ask, what's the subdominant contribution to the partition function? Like something that's subdominant in N. Okay, so we did that. Okay, just by looking at the free field theory carefully and looking at what states you count that aren't given by some coarse grainer, you can see that the first correction at finite N is due to the kind of operators that Matt Kleban was looking at, things like baryon operators. Something with an epsilon tensor and n phis, okay, this is another ON invariant that's not bilinear. There's a slight problem here that phis commute and epsilon's anti-commute, so this doesn't look too good. So what you need to do is you need to sprinkle various derivatives on these phis to make the thing anti-symmetric. What's the delta of this operator? It's not quite that. So you have n phis, that makes something like n over 2. But you have to put in, it turns out, like square root of n deltas to get an anti-symmetric. So this is like n to the 3 half. So the leading correction to this main partition function goes like e to the minus n to the 3 halves. Okay. Not e to the minus, and we would expect a subleading saddle would go like e to the minus 1 over g Newton, which is e to the minus n. So this is much smaller than that. So there don't seem to be things that correspond to subleading gravitational saddle. So this is very puzzling.
That's a very high spin.
No, this is scalar. You can contract all the spin indices up to make it a scalar. It's a scalar operator. So this is the leading correction at finite n. Okay. There are no power in the free theory. There are no power law corrections. Okay. And it's a very strange power. This is a lot like e to the minus 1 over the square root of h bar. It's e to the minus 1 over h bar to the 3 halves.
Are these operators condense in the high temperature?
I think roughly speaking, they condense. I don't know a way to make that precise, but that's roughly what happened. It's also true that very near the transition. Well, it's said metaphorically. Basically, what happens at high temperatures is the steam fields forget who they're paired with. Here, you're pairing operators in a funny way. If the fields forget who they're paired with, this operator doesn't have any extra correlation. So, what else? Near the transition, but below, just a second. There are effects that go like e to the minus n. You double scale the Gross-Witten transition, okay? And you know, as we always found in these double scale theories, that near the transition effects go like e to the minus n, e to the minus 1 over g string. there are effects like that near the transition. This is far away from the transition. So somehow the effect of operators like this goes from e to the minus n to the 3/2 to e to the minus n. So near the transition and below, there could be subleading saddles. So that is a possibility. There would be an effect like this, but the lowest delta operator is when they're all at one point.
Okay.
Yeah, that's you get if you excite it, then you have sort of some object with n things coming out from each other.
So one natural guess is that you could take a large black hole whose horizon size is much bigger than the ADS size and ask if in the limit where the size of the black hole is very large, it stops sourcing the higher spin.
Yeah, I think that would be like the idea of looking for a Poincaré symmetry black hole solution. And there is some way that's very simple. The Poincaré theory, you know, it's just mt squared, it's just free, you don't even know about the singlet constraint on Poincaré sections, just free scalar fields. It seems like the simplest place, and I think the place to look for such a solution would be in Poincaré solutions.
Sorry, can you clearly comment, why do we not know about the singlet constraint?
Because in Poincaré section, any temperature is the same as very high temperature. So in Poincaré section, as soon as you have non-zero temperature, you're instantly deconfined.
Well, you're always confined.
But it turns out you're instantly deconfined. So on the plane, this theory has entropy nt squared, you're done.
So really it's just a free theory with no
constraint. Free theory with no constraint.
And that's consistently dual to planar Vassiliev gravity? Is that
the that would be the proposal, yeah. And if the only reasonable conjecture there, I think, is that there's some kind of planar black hole. And that would be a good thing to look at. Yes?
There seems to be some tension here, because if the free theory was dual in finite temperature case to planar black hole, you'd expect to see dissipation in the free theory?
Not necessarily, I think.
Well, because you think there are no operators that perform. If you look at correlators, shouldn't you see data?
Yeah, but I mean, there are thermal states in essentially free field theory. I mean, the fact you don't need to have, you could have like quasi-normal modes without interactions. You know, it's not going to be the kind of black hole that we're used to. It's not going to scramble. It's not going to do that. But it could be a thermal state. It will have to have very funny properties for reasons that you know. Yes.
So given that you can change geometry and causality by these gauge transformations, do we know that what we already have is not a black hole in some other frame?
You mean which one? The
state of this.
You mean this t to the fourth? The only thing we know is it doesn't have an entropy proportional to n. There's no 1 over gn in it, 1 over g newton in it. That's all we know. Yeah.
It's kind of back a bit, but the true time series allow, which hasn't appeared.
Right. That will be the hidden extra parameter. That's right. So what I'm saying here is that the Chern-Simons gauge theory enforces its constraint in the limit of the level going to infinity. Okay. And the equation, which we'll come to, is the Gauss law says something like k, the level of the Chern-Simons, times the field strength on the spatial manifold, like the sphere, is equal to the charge or the current of the matter fields. As k goes to infinity on a sphere, it's the only real solution is that f equals 0 and j equals 0. But more on that in a bit. OK, well, this theory is peculiar and doesn't, in some ways, seem to have a lot in it. It seems very quiescent. The temperature is of order 1. It does break loose, but it seems rather tame. The 1 plus 1 theory seems, in many ways, more exciting. And we'll hear a little bit about this on Thursday.
Sorry, Steve.
Yeah.
The Wilson-Fischer fixed point?
Yes.
Is all this applied to that as well?
The transition of this kind happens in the Wilson-Fischer fixed point. We don't have enough control to examine the first non-perturbative correction in N. There you have a power series in 1 over N that you hardly solve. The fact that you have a transition at T equals square root of N is the same.
As far as the bulk description goes, you wouldn't expect a big difference with that boundary.
Yeah, the only thing that is harder to control is what the leading non-perturbative things in N are. You might, in fact, have an e to the minus n there. That's we haven't examined that. Of course, the numerical value of the transition is different. Gene is a very tough guy, and he computed it, so it's on paper. All right, well, now I want to turn to a place where, where things get more interesting, and this is things we're thinking about now with Shamik Banerjee and Simeon Hellerman. This theory is boring, in some sense, when the spatial manifold is a sphere. But as all of you know, Chern-Simons theory, the mechanism we're using to enforce a singular constraint, comes alive on spatial manifolds of different topology. So the kind of questions that David was raising will come to play. So suppose space is a T2 or some higher genus Riemann surface. Then all of a sudden, this thing we introduced to enforce singlets isn't quiescent. It has a rich life of its own. And we would expect that, at least if that's the way we formulate the duality, that there will be a whole new sector due to this. And so that's the thing we've been looking at. And I'll tell you some of the things we've learned. We aren't finished with this. The basic dynamics here is just if we consider a U1 gauge group and one complex scalar field. If you just consider the Chern-Simons theory, and here's the torus, and here's the one direction and the two direction, the holonomy angles we'll call A1. That's the amount of parallel transport, e to the, or the integral of A dot dx along here. And here's the holonomy angle, A2. The Lagrangian for the Chern-Simons theory, and here I'm going back to the classic work with Elitzur, Moore, Seiberg, and Schwimmer about the canonical formulation of Chern-Simons theory. You have a level K, A1 of T, A2 of T dot. And you see that A1 and A2 are canonically conjugate pairs. I guess the way I've written it is the position variable is A2. The conjugate variable, VL, the Q dot, is K times A1. So they form a phase space, the space of holonomies. Now I'm plotting holonomies, which are angles that run from 0 to 2 pi. This is a phase space, suitably scaled. And at large K, you have many cells in phase space that are the semi-classical states of the Chern-Simons theory. So you have K cells, and hence K is 1 over H bar. And you have K cells, and hence K states in this theory. And there's no Hamiltonian. Hamiltonian is 0, because all you have in the Lagrangian is PQ dot. So they're all degenerate. This is a classic thing we've learned in the quantum Hall effect. Now the question is, what happens when you couple them to matter? And I must say, I thought this problem was completely understood, but as far as we can tell, this problem hasn't been completely analyzed, so we had to do some pieces of it ourselves. We're not done, but the basic dynamics is just that when you add a scalar field with a covariant coupling, having a non-trivial holonomy makes the scalar field have higher energy. You've changed the boundary conditions on the scalar field from periodic to twisted. And the modes of the scalar field are at higher energy. So the scalar field energetics does know about the holonomy and dislikes non-zero holonomy. So this is going to change this picture. And if you imagine, for instance, having a very heavy scalar field and integrating it out, the first effect will be some kind of something non-perturbative in the mass times the size of the torus times cosine A1 plus cosine A2. So the periodic and the holonomy angles. This was discussed by Wen and Yu in their argument that the splitting of these degenerate states with non-perturbative and at large mass. And so that this degeneracy, this topological degeneracy, is protected. Here we want to actually ask about the size of the splitting. If the scalar field doesn't like twisting, it means it wants the scalar field to stay at zero, not too high. It wants the homonymy to stay in these regions. So we can expand the cosine. We get A1 squared plus A2 squared. But these are just P and Q. So this looks like P squared over K squared plus Q squared. And that's a harmonic oscillator with H bar equals 1 over K. Okay. So we know, at least in the region where you can make this expansion, that you have a harmonic oscillator spectrum, and that these states are split into a harmonic oscillator spectrum with spacing 1 over K. The states don't go away, they're just split a little bit. Okay. Now, in the center here, the states get affected, at least this coefficient is not too small. But if we're interested in the very low-lying states of the theory, and that will be our goal here, is to study the lowest-lying states in this theory that will be important for the dynamics, you find that here you expect states of splitting 1 over K.
What's the mass? Why is there a mass?
Oh, sorry. Here I'm just imagining, for simplicity, that we add a mass to the scalar field. That will just be a control parameter. Now we're going to let the mass come down. Okay. So roughly the energy scales now, where you have a mass, you have 1 over the size of the torus, and you have this tiny splitting 1 over K. Now you can imagine lowering the mass. Okay. If this theory wasn't just a free scalar field, and it was the Wilson-Fisher fixed point, that theory will be gapped up on the torus. And its gap will be essentially 1 over the size of the torus. Like in 1 plus 1 conformal field theory, the Hamiltonian has a gap in finite volume. So the theory will be gapped. Its gap will be far larger than this splitting. So it looks like it won't do anything dramatic to this picture. The only way in which this picture will be dramatically altered is if you somehow can make the gap of the scalars come down all the way down here. Well, suppose you just have a free scalar field. A free scalar field has a zero mode. It essentially has a continuous spectrum on the torus. There, if you make the mass very small, you can imagine that this gap comes all the way down here. And then you have some interference between the very light scalar modes and these harmonic oscillator splitting. So in the Wilson-Fisher fixed point, the situation should look like this. But in the free scalar field, it's actually more intricate. You then have to worry about the combined action of the scalar zero mode, which has a continuous spectrum, and this harmonic oscillator. Well, there, the right thing to do is to actually write an effective quantum mechanics describing that scalar zero mode and the gauge theory.
So
yeah.
Are you interested in these three other boundary conditions for the scalar, aside from periodic boundary conditions on the torus?
No. Well, and in fact, I mean, the U1 dynamically adjusts the boundary condition. So that will just, if you have antiperiodic, the holonomy will like to live at pi. Okay, so that will just, the boundary conditions are dynamic variable. So the quantum mechanics that describes the basic situation is you'll have to keep the phi zero mode. That's something that's constant on the torus. Without the gauge fields, that would have a continuous spectrum. So there's really no gaps. And then you'll have to keep the constant A1 and the constant A2. That's P and Q. So you'll have some Hamiltonian that looks like, I'll write this as phi real plus phi imaginary. You'll have, in a Hamiltonian, you'll have minus D phi real squared minus d by d by imaginary squared. That's the scalar field zero mode Hamiltonian, plus this covariant derivative, if phi is constant, goes to phi star phi a1 squared plus a2 squared, if a is a constant. That's the coupling of the constant phi to the holonomy angle. plus phi real squared plus phi imaginary squared. P squared over K squared plus Q squared. So you see, if P and Q, if the holonomy were just zero, then you would have this continuous spectrum of the zero modes. But when the P and Q or the A1 and A2 are excited, it stops the zero mode. So you have some interplay between the harmonic oscillator here and the zero mode. And this Hamiltonian can be solved. And you write the total wave function of the phis and the q's as the product of harmonic oscillator zero modes. A harmonic oscillator of q, that just solves this harmonic oscillator. A harmonic oscillator and real of phi real. And a harmonic oscillator and imaginary of phi imaginary. If this has an eigenvalue of 1 over k, m plus a half, in a state like this, this just asks like a constant omega squared for these two harmonic oscillators. This is omega squared, though, so you have to take the square root. So the omega for these two oscillators is the square root of this. So the energy, there's one more thing. The Gauss's law constraint that says J equals zero says that the charge of this phi is equal to the charge of this phi. So that implies that n right equals n real equals n imaginary. So the energy is just 1 over the square root of k, the square root of m plus a half, that's omega for these oscillators, times 2n, call this n, 2n plus 1. So that's the spectrum of the Hamiltonian. You can see here that the gap has gone from 1 over k to 1 over the square root of k. Because this is 1 over k, it lets this oscillator come out and they fight back and forth. This 1 over square root of k you can see just by scaling. And this is the solution. So this is what happens when you have a very light, essentially free scalar field here on this tour. You have very light states, a spectrum of order 1 over the square root of k. They're not this light, they're not 1 over k, but they're still very light. So this theory, which started out, it was rather...
There's no longer any zero energy state.
That's right, there's no longer any zero energy state.
So it's like the scalar and all the harmonic oscillators would repel.
In some ways, yeah.
Squeeze, but
not in some ways, that's right. If the scale, if the zero mode runs out very far, it increases the energy due to this harmonic oscillator, so they have to make a balance.
So in order to focus only on the zero mode, the size of the torus has to be very small compared to k.
Well, no. If you're looking at very low energy states,
yeah,
that allows you to focus on the zero mode. If you looked at non-constant modes, there would be a gap of order 1 over L. So our goal here, as I said briefly, but let me emphasize it again, is to look at the lightest states in the spectrum.
But in order for there to be a separation between those two scales,
you need k large.
K large compared to L.
Right.
What happened to the zero mode on S2? You didn't discuss
there is no zero mode on. I'm sorry, there's no zero mode of the Chern-Simons field.
But there is for the scalars, so why didn't that contribute?
Well, no, there's an R5 squared.
Oh, okay. Sure,
that makes it positive. So there's no zero. So this suggests that this theory, which on the sphere was boring, if we impose the gauge constraint by a Chern-Simons theory, which, as I said, I think seems like a sensible thing to do, the theory comes alive. There's a whole bunch of very, very light states. Now, I guess my time is getting close. So let me just say that we think this situation, we think the scalings persist unaltered in the SUN case. The number of states in this situation, in the SUN case, we think we can study by just saying you have n commuting holonomies, which is what Chern-Simons does. So you have n decoupled harmonic oscillators, each one with energy splitting 1 over k. In the SUN case here, we're confused about the n dependence. The k dependence is clearly this. This just comes from scaling. You have a harmonic oscillator coupling the n scalars and the SUN holonomies, just like this, but there's some indices. And by scaling, you find 1 over square root of k. The n dependence is a little bit more mysterious. There's a, to return to a question that Joe asked, if our splitting is 1 over k in the SUM theory, there's a way of rewriting this. If we introduce an Atuff coupling, n over k, this gap we could write as lambda over n. Okay. This is reminiscent of light states that we'll hear about in the WM theory, and it's 2 plus 1 dual. And the power is different here. And so we find gaps of order 1 over n, but the most important thing is when k goes to infinity, the Atuff coupling goes to 0. It's also believed that there's a line of these fixed points as a function of lambda. Okay, so there is a hidden parameter in these theories that corresponds to having the Atuff coupling not infinite, but finite.
There's no sign of that parameter in the Vassiliev theory, though.
There is. Yeah, there's a free function that you can add, and it seems that, although the mapping is a little bit incomplete, there's a mapping between that free function and lambda.
A free function maps to lambda?
Yeah.
In
the couplings of the Vassiliev theory, there's an unspecified function. There's a room for an unspecified, some extra dimension. Okay. There's one function's worth of parameters, and it's determined by, and people think they can determine it as a function of lambda.
How do you map a free function to one parameter?
Well, there's other constraints on it. So it's believed that the Vassiliev has a deformation that accommodates this value of lambda. So the theory really should be thought of as a theory with one free parameter. And what this is about is saying that in some sense the original limit, when you take k to infinity, there seems to be some sort of singular development there. The states that come down in a very singular way. Although these states are already the gaps of order 1 over n, holding lambda fixed. Yeah.
So if there's a planar black hole, yeah, Vassiliev, then there should be a torus black hole, which is black hole shifting
in. You would think so.
And are these supposed to be the infrared excitations of that?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, it's very confusing how a black hole is going to know about gaps that go down with lambda. Because the lambda goes to zero limit is a very smooth limit of the theory. It just gets back to the original Vassiliev thing. So it
strict zero energy solutions on the boundaries you were seeing.
Because of the zero mode of the scalar field.
Zero mode.
Yeah, so it would have to be some treatment, but you have a lot of them. You have n of them. And so one has to understand the zero mode.
Yeah.
But it has n of them. It's not just like one bulk scalar running off. So you have to regulate that in a way. But that's I should say that we've concentrated so far on in this collaboration understanding the boundary behavior, and then hopefully people here, including Alex, are thinking about the bulk behavior. And one thing to do is to see how these things can mesh. Yes.
Probably said this. What is the growth of these states? These light states.
In SUN, well, there's probably the entropy is probably proportional to n, but these are just harmonic oscillators, so there's not some k in front. It's probably n log k.
Is it different from the three-dimensional case?
Well, I'm not sure.
I think that the states grow
exponentially. In k? In n certainly. I'm not sure what their behavior is in lambda, actually. Do you know? So let me just close by saying a few words about a situation that might be especially interesting for understanding the bulk. The torus is a little bit special. I mean, it will have a bulk interpretation. Everything does in ADS-CFT. Okay. The things that might have the most natural interpretation are spatial manifolds that are higher than Riemann surfaces. These and other situations have turned out to be hyperbolic black holes where you quotient the horizons by a discrete group. So what happens when you play this game on with a spatial surface that's a higher genus Riemann surface? Well, then you have phylonomies around each cycle of the higher genus Riemann surface. You have a pairing of A cycles and B cycles to make the phase space. And so you'll have, let's say in the U1 theory, you'll have sort of for each genus, you'll have a harmonic oscillator like this. But the most important fact is you have a minus R by square term. So we call it R by squared, where R is less than zero. So you have a potential that drives the scalar fields rapidly out to infinity. This, of course, is familiar to all of us that have looked on these hyperbolic situations. And so you have the scalar field wishing away, and the boundary conformal field theory is unstable, at least the free theory. There's several things to be said about that will improve things. First of all, in the Wilson-Fisher fixed point, you add a quartic coupling with a positive sign that can stop this runaway. So the critical OM theory probably doesn't run away to infinity. Okay. So some kind of non-zero VEV of phi squared develops. But the theory should make some sense. The other thing is, if you think about the gauge coupling, will have a structure like this. If phi stabilizes, you'll again have a harmonic oscillator with a fixed constant here. So you should have these very light states with gaps of order 1 over k from the harmonic oscillator. So the hyperbolic black hole should also have very light states in the critical theory. Although morally speaking, without this term, the runaway is complete. I should add that at finite level, the conformal field theory you got, and this is work of Aharoni and collaborators, there's a non-trivial fixed point where you add the phi to the sixth term. In 2+1 dimensions, phi sixth is marginal. You add the Chern-Simons dynamics, and you can find a non-trivial fixed point bouncing the phi to the sixth coupling against the Chern-Simons coupling. And you find a non-trivial fixed point with the coefficient of phi six being 1 over k squared. This is for large enough n. This is sort of, just as a sideline, this is shocking. This is the first new fixed point I know about that has been found using perturbative techniques since, I don't know, the 1970s. but it is. It's there. 2+1 dimensions, 3 Euclidean dimensions. And you have Chern-Simons dynamics plus a scalar field dynamics. And the Chern-Simons gauge dynamics bounces
it's
back.
Only when R is not zero.
No, this is in flat space. Okay, but then if you put if you imagine you have this coupling and put it on negative curvature, you actually can balance this against this and find a value of phi, I guess, that balances, what is it? Phi squared is of order k. So you have a runaway, but it's not strictly infinite. But the runaway diverges as k goes to infinity. So I think for all intents and purposes, it's infinite. But the theory is not completely unstable.
Even
the free theory. The theory at finite k, that is the relevant fixed point theory.
The sector of the free
theory. Of the analog of the free theory.
The finite k free theory.
Yeah, but the fixed point that's closest to the free fixed point. So these light states and this runaway are things that cry out for a bulk interpretation, and I'm sure we'll have discussions about that here. So maybe I'll stop there, and if you have any more questions. Okay.
light states only occur because of topology on the boundary.
Yes, that's right.
So that's something very like edge states on the, even from the bulk perspective.
Yeah, that's,
there's no way you can think about them as local modes.
That's very interesting and puzzling in terms of its interpretation as a bulk theory. They're almost, it suggests maybe they're wrap rains of some sort, a very light tension. But you're quite right. That's a important puzzling aspect of it.
You also said something about being interested in the citrus space. You haven't mentioned it.
I'll let that happen tomorrow.
But I have a more basic question about what a black hole is. It was mentioned that because of the large gauge symmetry, causal structure is not inherent.
Yes.
How is a black hole defined? As a representative of a gauge orbit in which you have a metric with an event horizon? Or how does one define
it? I think I'm going to punt that question to some other members of the audience. Do you, something here, want to take that up?
Well, I would say that in four dimensions, I don't know how to define it. There is a definition in three dimensions.
Yeah, and then
the definitions of Pear and Michael and basically what you do there is, an analogy to the BTC black hole, you define a black hole by the connection, the associated connection that has a trivial holonomy around the contractible time cycle.
There are many confusing things about that situation.
That's as well. There is a definition and a yes.
I mean, that's the statement that it's smooth at a place that would be the horizon, but why it deserves to be called a horizon is unclear.
It's at least a gauge invariant.
It's a statement about solutions to the equations in motion.
Okay. Yeah.
Why do we call those solutions black holes?
Yes, not necessarily a black hole. I mean, you need some Lorentzian definition of that to show that as an event horizon. It's not just a ball.
But that's the thing. Like, why should we be thinking about event horizons? Like, I guess the question is, are there thermodynamic solutions? Are there solutions that you can attribute entropy to them? Mm-hmm. And these are the solutions that you can have a thermodynamic behavior and you can have an entropy. Now, do they have an event horizon? No, because the theory is
that they call them black holes.
Let's call them the thermodynamic thermal state in the bulk.
I mean, that's because we're doing that.
They have an energy and it's free energy.
Yeah,
is there a sense in which you get things that look classical when you take objects that are much larger than the AES radius size? That's, you can't take a large radius limit, but in this reversal degree.
I mean, that might be in the 3+1 Basiliad theory. That's sort of what you're saying, is that if you took a gigantic black hole whose horizon is effectively planar, then that is a real black hole.
But I don't know why you would think that the curvatures would be less than ADS so that you could decouple all the fields.
Well, I mean, roughly speaking.
ADS black holes have curvatures that are ADS on the nodes. And they only would have been.
Yeah, so you can't get away from
it. I don't think you can decouple all the fields. Yes?
So you introduced the Chern-Simons sort of sector originally. Because you said you want the local description of this single constraint. But now you're getting all this interesting dynamics out of it.
Yes.
And it's all through non-local operators, like your Wilson curves. So does that bother you a little bit?
It does. But the Chern-Simons theory has a Lagrangian. You know, so it's something that you will have a local stress tensor when it's coupled to matter. And so it, I know what you mean.
The boundary theory ends up being very non-local because of all this Wilson dynamics in a sense. Well, at least non-local operators aren't really.
Yeah, non-local operators are significant. But, you know, we've seen that even in Yang-Mills theory, holonomies around non-trivial cycles show up in the dynamics, in hyperbolic black holes. The Wilson lines have non-trivial consequences for the behavior of those black holes. So there are, whenever you have things like gauge theories, Wilson lines can come into the game and create novel dynamics because of, let's say, graph strings or something. So it's not the case that more conventional theories have no such non-local dynamics. What's puzzling here is that everything seems to be non-local. And I agree that that's puzzling. Yes.
So there's one case where I would have thought the bulk description of thermodynamics would be easy.
Yes.
Which was the confined phase on S2, where I might have thought it's corresponding to the linearized similar fields. Mm-hmm. Does that matching work?
Yes, that matching works. I shouldn't have said that. If you compute the partition, I shouldn't say. Right. Sorry. If you compute the partition function at temperatures less than this TC, it's exactly the sum of this census of higher spin fields that's known. It's exactly the thermodynamics of the statistical mechanics of those.
Oh, that's what you're saying. That's accounting for.
That's right.
Yeah. So what's the bulk explanation of this volume of the S2 squared? How does that appear?
It just turns out when you take that sum of higher spin fields, roughly it's Taylor series.
Just because that volume is set at the ABS scale, and somehow that's a
That's equal to the sum of x minus y to the k, derivative. You do a Taylor series expansion of this, and the coefficients are just the higher spin fields. And so one way of enumerating these higher spin fields, I'm being schematic here, is by summing up the Taylor series.
Okay.
And so that's a nice way of grouping together the derivatives is by saying that things are far apart, and it just works.
Consequence of the parity violation of the Chern-Simons boundary theory. So isn't that
at finite k there is. Yeah.
Is that, I mean, I don't know what the Cecilia theory is, but
Cecilia theory is parity violating.
Well, not as
when there, k is. I mean,
when k is finite.
Extra function,
yes,
that you were talking about.
Yes.
It is a parity violation.
And I frankly suspect that's the reason that people shied away from looking for this new procurement fixed point. That's a sociological thing I'm curious about. Okay.